this episode of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska,
I realized that it wasn't coveralls. It was locks of hair, big curly locks of hair.
We'll hear from Richard Mustaine about ethereal mysteries that make you wonder if you are dreaming or not. And also,
he's not coming back. Because when they say they're coming back, they never do.
Polly Napik Andrews tells us how the eyes of a child see us. I'm Chris Zwolinski, executive producer of Dark Winter Nights. Thank you for joining us on this season 11 episode of Dreams. Now, childhood dreams are one thing, but if you are cold or wet, or in this case, tired, as we are about to hear from Richard Mustaine, dreams can have an entirely different impact.
I'm a local haul road driver here for a company here in Fairbanks. Me and my wife moved up here about 10 years ago. The story I'm going to tell you happened my second winter here in 2016. At the time, I was doing what we call switches. It's where a Fairbanks driver takes two empty trailers and heads south, and an Anchorage driver takes two loaded trailers and comes north. We meet in the middle, and we switch. You know, we take each other's trailers and return to our terminals. On this particular evening, I was just a little ways out of Fairbanks here on a hill that we call Little Bonanza. I don't know if any of you know where it's at. It's kind of about a 2 mile upwards pull with a curve in the center. Driving along there, it's a dark winter night, you know. It's about minus 20 or so, or somewhere in there. I can't remember what month it was exactly. But as I was coming up the hill and starting into the curve, my headlights started to come on to a gentleman walking up the side of the road. He had dressed in black coveralls and a black stocking cap. He was walking on the opposite lane, that shoulder the same direction I was going. And I thought, man, what a night to be walking. There wasn't no way I could stop. You know, my truck and trailers together weigh about 136,000 pounds. And I'd already made plans, or was making plans in my thoughts there to stop at the top of the hill and go back and see if this gentleman needed some help, you know. I hadn't seen no car with flashers on or any wreck site, and just figured he might need some help. And as I was coming on through the curve, my headlights hit him full on, and I realized that the coveralls he was wearing weren't black. It was a two-tone brown, a light brown and a dark brown. And at the same time, I realized that it wasn't coveralls. It was locks of hair, big curly locks of hair. And I was trying to make sense of this, and at that instant, I realized I wasn't looking at a man. It was Bigfoot. Let me tell you, when your reality goes from something that you might have been true, but it's probably myth, and it's reality all of a sudden. Right there in front of you, 20 feet away from me, is a man upright walking, covered in hair. I mean, Bigfoot. No way, no myth, no, it's real, reality. What that does to you, to your core person, changes you instantaneously. I went from a 45-year-old man to an 8-year-old little boy like that. You know, my whole life realizing I was wrong. Bigfoot's real. He exists. I was driving truck, my hands and legs locked up, vibrating, and all the breakers inside of me are going on and off. You know, it's Bigfoot, you know. And let me tell you, as my headlights were leaving Bigfoot, if that moose wouldn't have turned and stepped across that guardrail, if he wouldn't have turned and stepped across that guardrail for the rest of my life, I would have been that little old truck driver man in a restaurant cafe in the corner with the facial eye tick and the shakes going, "What's out, boys? He's out there. I saw him." Thank you.
That was Richard Mustaine. If you enjoy these true stories from Alaska, please subscribe to our podcast. We also have full recordings of all past live events on our Dark Winter Nights YouTube library. We are always actively looking for more great Alaska stories. If you, or someone you know, has a great true story that you'd like to share, you can email story@darkwinternights.com. Our story submission rules are simple. It must be true, it must have happened to you, and it must have happened in Alaska. I'm Chris Zwolinski, your host for this episode. And next, I thought it was important to bring this very moving story to the stage because it brings attention to life circumstances that most of us have never had to experience. Polly and her twin sister Lolly were just kids when I met them in a homestead in the mountains of the Brooks Range. In the story you are about to hear, she is going to share her memories of growing up and tells her story in a moving way with an ability to take you to the villages where she was raised and into the mountains that she loves so much. As the old saying goes, the journey is not always a straight line, as you will hear from our host, Brittany Carnes, when she introduces Polly on our Dark Winter Nights live stage this last winter at Herring Auditorium in Fairbanks.
I think as kids, a lot of us have dreams about how things could be as we're growing up or when we're grown up. But as life goes on, for a lot of us, those don't come true. Or for our next storyteller, though, one of them did. Please help us welcome Polly Napick Andrews, telling a story called Two Gold Stripes.
My early childhood years were spent in Southwest Alaska, and my twin sister and I had been adopted at birth in 1984. And some of the good memories that I can recall of those early times in Bethel include learning to ride a bicycle. I can remember the feeling of my adoptive mom with her hand on my back, and she was pushing me on that bicycle, and I was using my little legs to pedal as fast as I could until I crashed into the grasses and fell over and got up and said, "Let's do that again." And the smell of breakfast in our kitchen as she danced around and flipped pancakes, sang to and whistled to the tunes of Creedence Clearwater Revival. And the feeling of my twin sister and I sitting on the tundra with her on a beautiful summer day, picking berries with the warmth of the sunshine on our faces. And I also remember the times when our home wasn't safe. At night, the adults began to come into the door one by one, carrying that familiar old brown bottle of R&R booze again. And the sound of the adults becoming louder and the music becoming louder. And my twin sister and I knew exactly where our hiding spots were. And eventually, you know, our home had had so many interventions with the Bethel Police and the Division of Family and Youth Services, and we had been removed so many times from our home that we were permanently removed from the care of our adoptive mom and dad, and we were placed into another foster home again. And from there, we went to another foster home, and another foster home, and another foster home. All the while wondering, you know, where is mom and dad? Where's our family? And not understanding why we were in so many places. By the time we were about 5 years old, we were placed in the care of our adoptive grandparents who lived in the tiny little Yupik village of Lower Kalskag, which is about a 4-hour boat ride upriver from Bethel. And we were living with our grandparents, very much living a subsistence way of life. You see, in the springtime, we would go to spring camp, where we would live in a canvas tent that was in the snow, and our aunties and uncles would be hunting muskrats and beaver and ducks and geese and swans. And in the summertime, we were living at fish camp on the Kuskokwim, where our uncles would go out and drift net for salmon, return with a boatload full of fish, and our aunties would cut fish and hang them to dry. And it was a beautiful way to live, and in many ways, safer than what my twin sister and I had been experiencing early on. And you know, when you're living in a tiny little Yupik village like that, and you're living a subsistence way of life, it's a big deal for a little airplane to fly into your community, you know? And I remember being that little girl, and I'd hear an airplane fly above, and I'd always look up and wonder to myself, could that be my dad? When I was 5 years old, an aunt of mine, she was going through a stack of old photos. She hands me a photo and she says, "This is a picture of your dad." And I took that little 3x5 in my little hands and I looked at it. In that photo was a tall white man wearing a red Pendleton shirt, aviator sunglasses, and he was standing in front of a small white airplane with two gold stripes. And I held that photo in my hands, and I stared at it for the longest time, and I thought to myself, that's my pilot dad. And every time I heard a plane fly above, I always looked up at it. And one day, in 1991, I'm playing on the side of the dirt road with a cousin of mine. We both have sticks in our hand. She and I sat in the dirt together, and we were drawing pictures of our house, drawing figures of our family, when suddenly I heard a buzz above me, and I looked up, and what I could see was an airplane flying circles above my village. The small white airplane with two gold stripes. And I dropped that stick in my hands, and I ran as fast as I could to my grandparents' house, and I remember running up those wooden stairs and through that porch and through the door and into the living room and exclaiming to my grandparents, "My dad is here, my dad is here! I saw his plane in the sky, my dad came for me!" And about 20 minutes later, I heard the engine of a 4-wheeler pull up to our house. So my twin sister and I skipped outside to see who it was. And what we saw on the 4-wheeler was a tall white man wearing a red Pendleton shirt and aviator sunglasses. And he looked at us and he got off the 4-wheeler and he said, "Hi, I'm your dad." And just speechless and in awe, without words, my twin sister and I led this stranger into our house. He carried this big box and he introduced himself to my grandparents. And in this big box, he had gifts for them. He had this big block of muktuk that he had for them. And he pulled out fruits and vegetables and all those things that we don't see in the village. And he spent that evening getting to know us. And my twin and I finally spent a little time getting to know this new dad of ours. Out of that box, he also pulled out books and games and puzzles. He had brought everything to make a pizza, and we don't have pizzas in the village. I can remember the feeling of rolling out the dough with our new dad, placing the marinara sauce all over and the little veggies and the little salamis all over, baking it together. And I'll never forget that night, you know, he read books to us. And my twin sister sat on one lap and I sat on the other lap. And my twin looked up at our new dad and she said, "Can we call you Daddy?" And he looked down at both of us and he said, "You sure can." And we spent the next 2 days in the village taking a lot of walks with this new dad of ours, you know. When we were walking around the dirt roads of our village, he had collected this whole entire group of village kids that were following him because he was the only white man in a village of 400 Yupik people. We were like, wow, that's our pilot dad. And after 2 days of spending time with us, he said that he had to leave. He said there was a battle that he had to fight, this custody battle, and he promised that he was gonna come back. And I remember my twin sister and I sadly going to the little airstrip with him to see him off. And I remember the feeling of all of your dreams breaking before you as I watched his airplane, that little airplane with two gold stripes, taxi down the runway and take off and disappear into the clouds. When I saw that airplane disappear into the clouds, I thought to myself, he's not coming back. Because when they say they're coming back, they never do. And in those coming weeks, every time I saw an airplane, I would look up hoping to see those two gold stripes. And that airplane did come back. And when it landed in our village, the door pops open and out pops a little girl, and Dad says, "This is your sister." And the third time that airplane landed in our community, out came two grandparents out of that airplane, grandparents who had flown all the way from Minnesota to Alaska to our tiny little Yupik village to meet us. And I remember feeling so, so happy, overwhelmed with joy, because every time that little airplane landed, it felt like our family was becoming more whole and we were becoming more whole. And the fourth time that little airplane with two gold stripes landed in our village community, Dad looked at Lolly and I and he said, "Remember that battle I told you I was gonna go fight? You know how I told you I was gonna go up to bat for you too?" We said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, I want you to know that I won that battle and it's time to take you girls home with me." And so we hopped into that little airplane with Dad, and we made that trip all the way here to Fairbanks and landed that airplane. I remember Dad saying, "Well, where do you two girls wanna eat?" And we said, "McDonald's." And he said, "How do you girls know about McDonald's?" And we said, "We saw it on TV." When we came here to Fairbanks as those two 6 going on 7-year-old little girls, there were so many things to adjust to, so many big changes in our life that had just happened. We had just come from a tiny little remote Yupik village to this huge urban city. We'd never seen a paved street before or a 2-story house before. And when we started going to school at Pearl Creek Elementary, we started going to school in a place that had more kids in it than our entire village community had. And there were so many things, and there were some rough patches and bumps along the way. You know, Lolly and I had gone through a lot of trauma in our lives, but Dad spent a lot of time with us. He spent time, you know, telling us stories and taking long walks with us and reading books to us and having family dinners around a table. And he always told us that, you know, even when tough things happen, what we're always going to have is a family. And one of the books that he would read to us at night was called Tough Stuff. And it was a little book about how kids deal with and relate to trauma that's happened in their lives. And I could still remember, you know, leafing through those pages of that book, the little cartoon characters on there. And Dad read that book to us a lot. And that little white airplane with two gold stripes, what that airplane immediately became was the centerpiece and the identity and the strength of our family. Because every opportunity that Dad had and every weekend where the weather was clear, he would load that airplane with my sister and I and all of our winter gear, and we would fly off into the Brooks Range and the wilderness again. He flew us every single weekend that he could, way up north to the Arctic. We flew all over the Brooks Range, all over the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. We would land on sandbars and gravel bars and glaciers. We would set up tents on the glacier and camp there together. And Dad taught us how to fish and how to hunt with a rifle from an early age. And so that airplane brought us everywhere. It didn't matter if it was a hot summer day or 42 below. We were jumping in that airplane, and Dad would be like, the airplane flies better the colder the weather is. You know, and that plane would bring us so many places, and we were in so many situations that Dad called and referred to as building character. You know, going across a raging river after it was swollen, after having rained for days with like 40-pound packs on your back and having to unbuckle it for safety. And we're going across this raging river, and Dad is like, we're building character. And we're going up these mountains in the Brooks Range with that 40-pound backpack on our backs, you know, and grabbing dirt and grasses just to get to the top of the mountain. And Dad looks behind and he says, we're building character. And we're going across these soggy, wet muskegs and boggy areas with mosquitoes all over biting us and blisters forming on our feet. And Dad says that we're building yes. So that was our entire childhood, is all of those trips all over the state of Alaska. And when I went and became a parent of my own and had three children, Dad was sure to instill those same family values and that same sense of adventure with my children, his grandchildren. I remember the feeling of them being 3, 5, and 7 years old, leaning into our 170 Cessna and buckling them into my dad's airplane as they got ready to fly off to the next adventure with Grandpa again. And that was the life that they were able to have too. So this past July, my kids and I were here in Fairbanks, and we were visiting Dad. You know, he lives up on top of a hill out in Goldstream. And we were visiting Dad, and Dad says he wants to talk to me. So I sit down with him on his deck. He's sitting in a chair, and I'm sitting in a chair, and there's the Alaska Range in the distance, and he's smoking on his cigar. And in between puffs of his cigar, he says, well, I've decided to sell the airplane. I can still remember the weight that statement carried. And so Dad and I, we spent time on the deck talking about what our final trip could look like with that little white airplane with two gold stripes. So this past September, the kids and I came up here to Fairbanks, and we got together with Dad, and we flew up north to the Brooks Range to our favorite place, a place called Crevice Creek, tucked in the mountains way up north, and we landed there. And we spent 4 days soaking in the beauty and all the past memories of that place. My dad and my kids and I and family friends, and gosh, we spent those 4 days telling stories, sharing meals together, walking those same familiar trails that we had walked for many years before. And on day 4, it was time for our final flight back to Fairbanks. And I'll always remember the feeling of those rubber tires leaving that runway for the final time. And I remember flying up, 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 and gazing out of the window at the beautiful landscapes below me, trying to soak in every single moment, because every single moment seemed to really, really matter. And I remember looking out that window at all those familiar tundra landscapes, those little river tributaries, the same mountains we'd probably flown over hundreds of times before, and the brilliance of those fall yellow colors beneath us. And finally, we landed at Chena Marina Airstrip, and we opened the doors of our little airplane, and we all jumped out and unloaded our gear like we had many, many times before. We knew the routine. And I remember thinking to myself in that moment that 6-year-old little girl could have never imagined that here we would be, years later, 3 generations of us, my dad, myself, my daughter, and my 2 sons, all of us with our hands on the wing struts, pushing together our family airplane into its final parking place, Huyana.
Polly Napick Andrews.
Polly also expresses herself through song.
Ooh, nani, dang vawalaku.
We're listening to her version of Seal Boy, a song based on Yupik oral tradition. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska, the Dreams episode. It was edited by Robin. I'm Chris Zwolinski. Remember, these are the stories we tell up here in Alaska on Dark Winter Nights.